Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Dutch 17th century homes typically would have included a variety of wall decorations, including curtains, mirrors, and pictures. Many specialists in genre painting represented interiors with paintings and prints of recognizable subjects. These pictures within pictures are sometimes, though not always, a significant clue as to the interpretation of a painting. This lecture, given by Eric Denker on December 19, 2017, at the National Gallery of Art, explores the added or reinforced symbolism of these depictions in the context of the genre painting of Vermeer and his contemporaries. The symbolic use of mirrors is also considered. This lecture is in conjunction with the landmark exhibition Vermeer and the Masters of Genre Painting, Inspiration and Rivalry, on view from October 22, 2017 through January 21, 2018. The exhibition examined the artistic exchanges among Johannes Vermeer and his contemporaries from the mid-1650s to around 1680, when they reached the height of their technical ability and mastery of genre painting.
Good afternoon. I'm Eric Denker with the staff of the Education Division, and my topic today is pictures in painting. Dutch 17th century homes typically would have included a variety of wall decorations, including curtains, including mirrors, and including pictures. Many specialists in genre painting, both of the middle and aristocratic classes, represented interiors with paintings and prints of recognizable subjects. The subjects might be landscape or seascape, they might be mythological or biblical, they might be still life or even genre. The function of that rectangular shape on the wall may be as simple as a part of a structure, a geometric design, or perhaps a bit of color needed in one part of a composition. Or a generic picture subject might give added resonance to the mood or the tenor of a painting, a bucolic pastoral image that reinforces the tranquility of a domestic scene. The presence of paintings might speak to the rank and class status of a family. These pictures within pictures are sometimes, although not always, a significant clue as to the interpretation of a painting, either emphasizing or even contrasting with the ostensible subject matter depicted. And it's salient for us to keep in mind right from the beginning that these background illustrations are sometimes just a few inches in size, often far less detailed than the subject of the painting, less focused. Of the 68 paintings in the exhibition, over a third have paintings in the background. Others have maps, tapestries, and sculpture. And what I hope to explore today is the added or sometimes reinforced symbolism of these representations in the context of the genre painting of Vermeer and his contemporaries, with a few asides on what I hope to be relevant subjects. Whenever we see a picture within a painting, we should be quite aware that it's there intentionally, that it is not simply put there arbitrarily. As in the case of Manet, when he does this portrait of Émile Zola, the latter part of the 1860s, not a commission, but a work that he wished to do in thanks for Zola writing about the Impressionists and Manet, he not only puts an extensive still life there on the desk, an inkwell, pens, an open book. He not only signs it there on the desk to give some indication both of his authorship of the painting, but also of Zola's scholarship. But in the background, the three images that are up there on the wall are there for specific reasons, so that we can see Zola and Manet's interest in the Japanese color woodblock print, so that we can see in the far upper right-hand corner his interest in Spanish art. That's an etching by Goya after Velázquez's Los Borrachos, his interest in Spanish art. And even photography is represented by the photograph of his painting Olympia, which he had shown publicly about 5 years earlier. We often have the case in Dutch and Flemish 17th century art that there is a print or an illustration that's on the wall. And these remind us of the importance of emblem books to Netherlandish culture. Emblem books were books of proverbs. They were accompanied by crude illustrations, either woodcuts or sometimes engravings. And the image that is included on the page of the emblem often would remind people of the proverb itself. And so an empty barrel would in fact go along with the saying, the empty barrel makes the most noise. A full barrel, the full barrel doesn't resound. These are expressions that they used. Much in the same way that we quote these expressions from Poor Richard's Almanac when we're taught in elementary school and in junior high school. The squeaky wheel gets the most grease, that kind of expression. And so when we look at an image such as the David Teniers that you see up here on the left of peasants in a tavern enjoying themselves but not behaving particularly well, the image on the wall that seems to be tacked up on the wall, which I've reproduced enlarged on the right, shows an owl, a creature often associated with darkness, nocturnal activity, but also with glasses, spectacles on one side and light on the other, and it illustrates a Dutch proverb that says, what good are spectacles and light to the owl if he refuses to use them? What good is education to the peasants if they're only going to play cards and smoke and pass out and go off with loose women? Sometimes when we see an illustration such as this, it has to do with just status. So that this is a fairly new acquisition here at the National Gallery, the Jacob Achterveldt. And as you look at it, it's about charity. A young boy, it's a boy despite the costume, that's how young boys were dressed as well, giving charity, alms, to people at the door. And here we see two paintings, one above each doorway as we look from the hallway into a larger room beyond where the proud parents sit. And those are two landscapes. They're impressive landscapes, but we're not meant to read overly into them. Now, one of the things that we should bear in mind, and is illustrated in the exhibition here in this work by Maas, is that Dutch paintings often had curtains over them. They weren't glazed, they didn't have glass, but they had curtains over them. And this is a painting that is in the first room of the exhibition, and I've taken the time not only to extract it from the painting, but actually to change the color values so that it would be a little bit easier to read, and I've taken that liberty with a number of the illustrations today. So it wasn't uncommon to have a painting that actually had a curtain hanging in front of it. This will come into play in the course of our talk as well. We know that it was not uncommon for trompe l'oeil illustrations, such as this Adrian van der Spelt with Franz von Mieris, to actually paint the curtain onto the scene. And so that's not a separate curtain, but it's painted as if it's been pulled back to reveal that beautiful floral still life. I think it's important to remember that when we see images of still life, that there is a story that most 17th century painters would have known, and it's a story based in antiquity, based on Pliny the Elder and his natural history, where he describes the story of Zeuxis. And Zeuxis, the renowned painter of the 5th century BC, even though nothing continues to survive today, was renowned, and he was so good that it was said that he could charm animals and birds. And so he's challenged to a contest. And the contest is, the challenge comes from Peirasius. And so Zeuxis paints grapes that are so beautiful, that are so vivid, that when he places them on stage, birds come down and peck at the grapes. And Peirasius puts his painting on stage with a curtain in front of it. And when Zeuxis goes to remove the curtain, what he finds is that the curtain is painted. And Zeuxis says, though Zeuxis could fool the birds, Peirasius is the greater painter because he could fool a human being. And so this trompe l'oeil idea, very important, and when you see either grapes or a curtain in this way, it should evoke that story for you as well. And we could point out that Vermeer uses this same strategy in this painting of a woman reading a letter painting not in the exhibition, it's in the Grimaldi Gallery in Dresden, where the curtain has been pulled back. And so that brings us to the work that are in the show. And here we have these two paintings by Metsu. They are pendants. They are meant to be seen together. The man writing on the left, assumingly writing a love letter to the woman who is receiving a letter and reading the letter on the right. And in the background of both, there is a painting. And I should hasten to add that the paintings are framed differently. Much has been written, and the wall label would suggest to you that the maid pulls back the curtain, as we've just seen in other paintings, to expose a painting that is, in this case, of a seascape and of a storm in that seascape, boats that are bobbing up and down in heavy waves, suggesting, with the Dutch proverb, that love doesn't always have a very smooth experience, that there are difficulties, that there are tribulations within as well, a turbulent course that love might take. The painting that you see here, which is by Ter Borch, is difficult to make out, but you can see the frame there in the background, and you can see the curtain has been pulled back. And so what I wanted to illustrate here by blowing that up and changing the tonality a little bit is it's a little seascape, but the sea is calm. And you can see the sailboat here, not unlike the sailboat that is in the new acquisition for the National Gallery, the Van Hooyen, that is a view of Dordrecht from the north. And so the curtain, the stylish frame, the painting. And we often get information about how works were framed. Even if we can't make out the picture, we get some information about the frames, such as you can see in this painting as well. The frame that's within the landscape, that has the landscape, within the image of the man writing, is the cue for the kind of frame that the National Gallery of Art in Dublin used for the two paintings. When we look at it, it's interesting to note that there hasn't been as much analysis of the depiction within this painting in the picture in the background as with that of the woman receiving the letter. Here it is blown up. It's a simple pastoral scene. Perhaps some sheep, goats, a cow. As I mentioned, it's quite small. Blowing it up doesn't make it that much more readable. It seems to be the kind of Italianate landscape that we could expect of a Jan Boot or a Berkham or a Paulus Potter. There, you can see it quite clearly in the background. And that odd shape that you see here seems to me to be the kind of odd shape that you see from behind, and the amassing of different shapes, the way you would see in this Dutch painting, Berkham painting from the 17th century, or in this Paulus Potter. Look at that odd shape and the way the leg sticks out. That's the kind of work they are. But I would also suggest, as you look at the painting, that he's a much more elegant, fashionable gentleman, and that the frame that you see on his painting is a more up-to-date frame in the 1660s than the ebonized frame that you saw the nurse, the maid, pulling back from the painting of the Rough Seas. And again, Potter-like paintings that could be that kind of pastoral image. What do they suggest? Perhaps a certain harmony, a certain domesticity, a calm. And there's a Dutch phrase, and I must give credit to Henriette Verhoeven, who is here in the, in fact, Center for All Things Dutch here at the National Gallery when we go to Dutch history, that there is a phrase that goes with this about keeping your sheep on high ground, about taking care despite other worries. In the work that you see here, a work that is in some ways not to be overinterpreted, we do have the figures together. We do have a clear painting in the background. But as you look at them, this is by Breckelum, the gallant gentleman, there are landscapes as well that can still be stormy. It doesn't have to be a seascape. And you can see that here, and I've taken the liberty of blowing it up there. And I've juxtaposed it with a rather new painting to our collection by Roustal down there on the right. There does seem sometimes to be a connection with these small paintings, but not always. And I think it's important to realize that we need to look very carefully at the paintings and to not always trust reproductions, nor the catalog, which may have photographs that were taken as much as a year and a half or 2 years ago. So the brilliant painting that you see here by Caspar Netscher on the left appears not to have anything in that rectangle on the wall when you look at the illustration that's in the catalog. But closer examination, this is a photograph I simply took with a cell phone on the right, you can see that actually there is a landscape there. And so it bears very close examination when you're upstairs in the show. Likewise, when we come to this painting by von Mieris, it is an image that shows a kind of quack doctor taking the pulse of a woman who's in front of a bed. The suggestion is that she's lovesick. That landscape in the background doesn't really add very much to our understanding. It is more generic, as is in the De Hoek upstairs in the permanent collection, a landscape that might suggest simply the kind of calm and tranquility of the scene below. It's not heavy-handed in the symbolism. And you'll see a whole variety of different types of landscapes, and I've extracted some of them, and I've juxtaposed them with the work by Jan Both to suggest the kinds of paintings that inspire the artists who included them in the backgrounds. And we even have the example with Vermeer of reconciling two different landscapes, a landscape and a seascape, both calm, suggesting the calm perhaps within this scene as the maid has handed the letter to her mistress, who stops playing. She herself has been interrupted. There's her broom. She's left her shoes by the door. And this is a subject I'll return to. But before leaving this painting, notice the curtain that's been pulled back. It is both a curtain that we understand for its function within the room, keeping drafts down in a Dutch home, but also it plays on the curtain in front of a painting being pulled back. And that's a reference that we need to keep in mind. And there are the two, the landscape above and the seascape down below. In the exhibition, there is one example where in the background, we also have a still life. It's the painting from the National Gallery. It's the Vermeer of the woman writing a letter. She looks up from her writing. She looks out at us. And it's been suggested that it might be a portrait because of the way she looks directly out at the viewer. That's a fairly large painting in the background, and it's rather dark. And so, once again, I've tried to lighten it up a little bit so you can see that it's musical instruments, and that while that may have some very thin allusion to the idea of love and of music making, in fact, I think it's more likely to suggest the kinds of still lifes that could be seen on the market. This is an Italian one by Evarista Bascanis, with those musical instruments, making them a little bit more readable as a kind of variety of still life. But far more interesting to us, and I think far more important, are those scenes that, in fact, can be read that are figural scenes, whether mythological or biblical. And we can see that in this painting. And this is perhaps the largest of the paintings in the background of one of our pictures upstairs in the exhibition. And it's very clear to us what this is. That stark black frame around the image is of Moses being found by the Pharaoh's daughter. It's interesting because here, there are two things to note. First of all, the scale of that painting, which defines the whole upper right side and fixes those figures into place, given that her head might be about 9 or perhaps 10 inches, you can see that this must be at least 5 feet tall as a painting. You can see that the figures are central here, but that there is space and a landscape off to one side. And here is that detail blown up for you. Why, in this particular case, might Moses, and the finding of Moses, be relevant? The Dutch had a great affection for the Old Testament. They traced some of their own history back to it. And the story of Moses is generally to give evidence of divine providence, of a kind of reconciliation. And in a painting such as this, the distinction to be made is that letter, which appears to be thrown down on the floor, perhaps with anger, to which she responds, and the idea that it's balanced, reconciled with faith in divine providence. As you look, it is one of several times where Vermeer uses a painting that he uses in other places as well. Here is one possible inspiration out of a number that I considered. This is by Peter de Grebber, and it's from 1634, and you can see that grouping with the light on them of the Pharaoh's daughter, of the infant Moses, of the people surrounding in the nude down by the river. Interestingly enough, you can see the painting twice in the exhibition. Over here, you can see it behind the astronomer, but the scale is very different. Where it might have been 5 feet tall, now it appears to be about 2 feet tall. And though the figures are similar here, actually the composition has been changed. There is no landscape over on this side. So it's clear that Vermeer felt free to play rather artistically with the design, even of the paintings that we believe may have existed in those backgrounds. The work that you see here is by Heinrich Sorg, the lute player. And it's another interesting example where we have a small image in the background that I have tried to update by changing its color a little bit. You can see it back here. But I want you to notice the lute player himself. I want you to notice her particular expression as she looks up at him. And I want you to notice not only the dog, there are 18 dogs in the show. But this is the only cat. This is the single cat that's in the show down below her. And as you look at her, she looks a bit bored or a bit skeptical. Try and read her emotion. And so in general, in the past, this has been identified. This is this work. This has been identified as the story from Ovid's Metamorphosis of Pyramus and Thisbe. And I think that's certainly possible, given that we're not given a lot of detail. The stories that come from Ovid are often performed in the 17th century, both by theatrical groups and rhetoricians. And we know that there were 10 very popular stories, and this was one of those stories, along with Pluto and Persephone, along with Jupiter and Io, Mars and Venus, along with Cephalus and Procris. But while we're doing this kind of work, essentially we're trying to be detectives. We're trying to make a case. And so what I come to looking at this painting is the thing about the story and what the moral of the story is. And as we're trying to build the case, what the motive is for including this particular story. So here's the story from Ovid's Metamorphosis. Pyramus and Thisbe are two lovers that occupy connected houses, walls, but they're forbidden by their parents to be wed because of their parents' hatred of one another. They arrange to meet by a tomb under a mulberry tree, and they state their feelings for each other at that time. Thisbe arrives first, but upon seeing a lioness with a mouth bloody from a recent kill, she flees, leaving her veil behind. When Pyramus arrives, he is horrified at the sight of Thisbe's veil, assuming that a wild beast has killed her. Pyramus then kills himself, falling on his sword, and in turn splashing blood on the white mulberry leaves. Pyramus' blood stains the white mulberry fruit, turning them dark. Thisbe returns, eager to tell Pyramus what happened to her, but she finds Pyramus' dead body under the shade of the mulberry tree. Thisbe, after a brief period of mourning, stabs herself with the same sword. And in the end, the gods listened to Thisbe's lament and forever changed the color of the mulberry fruit into the stained color to honor the forbidden love. So that is the story. And what do we have as the moral of that story? Perhaps not to listen to your parents' rivalry. Perhaps not to flee simply and hide, because if you had courage, you could have stayed and saved your lover's life. And clearly, this is also the origins of the Romeo and Juliet story as well. But I don't know how that might apply precisely to the image. And so I started to search for other images and other stories. And one of the images that I found was that of Cephalus and Procris. And Cephalus, great hunter, is in love with Procris, who's terribly jealous, who hides in the bushes one day after she sees him go hunting, makes a little noise, and he hurls a javelin and kills her. And here the moral is of not being overly passionate, not being extremely jealous. And I wonder if perhaps there could be even bits of both. There are differences of opinion among the staff as to which one might be more vivid, might be more valid, and it's an interesting idea for us to leave it open-ended. Vermeer did this painting of a young woman seated at a virginal in the National Gallery in London. And she's seated at a virginal, an instrument associated with harmony and moderation, even though with the bass here, it seems as if we're being invited into making music together, but on a very gentle note, as opposed to the contrasting painting now in the background. The painting in the background is a known painting. It was owned by Maria Tins, who was Vermeer's mother-in-law. Here is the painting. There are several versions. This is the one that's in the Boston Museum. And you can see that it more or less frames her. And so perhaps what Vermeer is doing here is making a distinction between the kind of illicit love that is taking place back here, the idea of music in this context, to a more vulgar kind of love as coins change hands, and the woman at the virginal, the more innocent, more moderate idea of love. Once again, however, Vermeer used the painting in several different images, and I think it's interesting to us to see that he used it here. This is sadly the painting that was stolen from the Gardner Museum now many years ago. And there are different interpretations, but one of the things I want to point out here is to compare the two images, because not only has Vermeer subtly changed, look at the height of the head, and subtly changed the relationship here, but what I find very interesting as well is he wasn't tied to whatever the actual frame was, that he frames the painting differently in the two different paintings. And this goes back, I think, to compliment Alexandra Libby on a wonderful lecture she gave yesterday, to that idea of semblance without being, that idea of plausibility without actuality, and the idea that the artist takes artistic liberties where necessary within painting. I think it's interesting that it's juxtaposed with this painting, which for all the world looks like a Barbizon landscape there on the virginal. And again, the calmness of that image reinforces the moderation and modesty of the woman at the virginal. In the work of Jan Steen, Doctor's Visit, as you can see it here, once again, we have a tradition of the quack doctor who comes to check on the health of the lovesick, perhaps with the idea of checking for pregnancy as well. You'll notice that here, the maid holds a vial, a beaker that perhaps has urine in it to test for that pregnancy. She sits, her forehead on her hand, in front of a bed. The dog looks up expectantly down below as the child plays over here. And then we have these two paintings in the background. And quite clearly, the painting in the background is of an image of Venus and Adonis. And the idea of the dangers of love as well. So that Venus and Adonis, Venus falls in love with Adonis, who's the great hunter who thinks he's invincible. And she knows that he will be in danger. She attempts to persuade him not to go out on the hunt. But he goes. He's bored to death, and he dies. And so that's the image you see here. Notice there's a second image here that's a recognizable image. And I would suggest that the inspiration for these might have come either from the work of Cornelius von Haarlem over here on the left, or even closer to the source, that's Ferdinand Bol over here, in both cases with Venus above, Adonis down below, and the dogs looking expectantly off in the distance. The other image is by Franz Hals. It's called Peckelhering. He's a figure of a fool or a jester, a clown. And so his parallel is to the quack doctor. Interestingly enough, this painting has a number of other references that we should make, because we know that in one particular case, 100 years later, the French artist Greuze, Jean-Baptiste Greuze, understood from this engraving after von Mieris the subject that you can see here of the woman having broken eggs, a symbol of the loss of innocence. And these two have been tied together. What hasn't been tied together is that this figure is the direct descendant of this figure, which we just saw, because in fact, that's Cupid down there, rather than just a little boy playing with a bow and arrows. One of the most important comparisons in the entire exhibition comes at the end of this show, and it's between the dehok that you see here of the woman weighing coins, a stunning painting with its gold wallpaper background, the glitter coming off the coins, off the brass nail heads, the marvelous way in which the colors of her costume are rendered, and its comparison with the painting by Vermeer from our permanent collection, this painting. And the difference between the anecdotal quality of the work by de Hooch and the more transcendent meaning of the Vermeer. So that as you look at the Vermeer, it was our own curator, Arthur Wheelock, who first noticed that, in fact, there was nothing on the scale, that the scales are empty. So if you'd come to the gallery a generation ago, when I first started years ago, this was called A Woman Weighing Gold, except that she's not weighing gold. She's holding a balance, and that is all important. There are objects down on the table. There are pearls, gold chains, coins, but they're not on the scale, which is in balance. Instead, she glances down toward them with a painting framing her on the wall behind. And that painting is all important in this context because it is a painting of Christ at the Last Judgment. And what is he doing? He is weighing. It's a woman holding a balance. The visual juxtaposition of the woman in the Last Judgment is reinforced by the thematic parallels. To judge is to weigh. The scene has, as Arthur Wheelock has written, deep religious implications that seem related to St. Ignatius of Loyola's instructions in his spiritual exercises that the faithful, prior to meditating, first examine their conscience and weigh their sins as if facing judgment day. Only such introspection could lead to virtuous choices along the path of life. And so the woman holding a balance allegorically urges us to conduct our lives with temperance and moderation. The woman is poised between the earthly treasures of gold and pearls and a visual reminder of the eternal consequences of her actions. In that sense, it becomes a vanitas painting. The idea that wealth, that beauty, that fame are ephemeral, that the afterlife is eternal. One is set off against the other. Vermeer emphasized this message through this superbly refined composition and the lighting. Notice the hand holding the balance. It occupies a position directly in front of the frame's dark corner, while the scales are set off against the bare plaster wall on either side. an effect that Vermeer created through subtle spatial manipulation. Manipulation. Semblance without being. So if you look, you'll see the frame itself is an anomaly. Why would you have a frame gilded on one side and not on the other? What would be the effect of extending that gilding? In fact, it would distract us from the hand, which needs to be silhouetted against that dark frame in order to carry the message right there in the center of moderation and balance. And so it becomes all important to our understanding of this painting. And there is a detail, you can see there, Christ, and the head of the young woman is directly in front of where St. Michael would have been, who would also have been involved in those who were saved and those who were not. And there is a comparison between the more anecdotal detail on the right of the beautiful de Hooch and the subtlety of the Vermeer on the left. Now, I should also point out that if she looked up, she would be looking into a mirror. And mirrors are of importance to us here today as well. And I want to take a few minutes to talk about mirrors a little bit later on. Sometimes the meaning of a picture within a painting eludes us. I think this is one case where in the de Hooch that you see here, there is a painting over there leaning forward on the fireplace. It's an interesting painting, and once again, I've manipulated a little bit so you can see it better. That's what it looks like simply from the slide, but this is as I've taken a photograph with the cell phone. So it's an old man and a woman, and there's somebody kneeling near them, and there are angels over here, and they're holding something that looks like a cloud with something on top of it. It's a very Italianate painting, and as of yet, I haven't been able to establish the connection between them. Mirrors. Mirrors are certainly important. They were in every wealthy home and in many other classes as well. They open multiple narrative possibilities, many symbolic. Some are positive, the sense of sight, the sense of self-knowledge, the idea of truth. Others are about pride or vanity. And yet others have to do with the transience of love. Here, Terborch does this image of his half-sister, Gesine, and she looks down at the mirror as she is at her toilette. We see the maid behind her holding the ewer and the basin, symbols of innocence and purity, something of the nature of self-reflection. It comes home even more to us in this Terborch. So we look down at her, and we don't see her face. We see her from behind. But we get a glimpse of her, that slightly troubled look that's in the mirror held by the page. Perhaps the page and the maid get a better look at her. But in the meantime, we get this sense of seeing the figure at an intimate moment, a guarded moment, which is only revealed to us through reflection. In fact, it has been suggested, and you'll find in the catalog, that it's suggested it's based on this Bernardo Strozzi. It's a Vanitas painting of an older woman looking in the mirror, a painting that was reproduced by way of engraving. And this Bernardo Strozzi was already in a Dutch collection in Amsterdam, the Rentst collection, by 1647. In turn, it's believed that it had been inspired partly by Rubens, who had done this copy of a Titian, now in Liechtenstein, of a Venus looking into a mirror with an African attendant standing off to one side. We know that Rubens did over 30 copies of Titian's paintings, including one that's in our collection. Again, a woman, Venus, called Venus, looking in a mirror while two putti hold the mirror up. And here's the Rubens that is copied from that. Well, I think these are interesting suggestions, and I note that the mirror is not held just so we can see her whole face, but she seems to peek out at us as well. In fact, Terborch, who did this painting, had been at the Spanish court early in his career, had painted the Treaty of Munster, the treaty that established it de jure, the separation between the northern free Netherlands and the Spanish Empire, that after painting that in 1648, that he returned to Spain and that he worked with the king. He was a trusted diplomat. And so what I suspect is that he may well have seen this painting newly arrived back by Velázquez, having been painted in Italy, the Rokeby Venus, that shows us a mirror and a reflection. Who better than Velázquez for Terborch to emulate in this regard? And interestingly enough, this painting by Velázquez had been inspired by seeing this Rubens copy of Titian. The mirrors help us enter in to these intimate aspects of life. We see it here in this work of Terborch, a lady at her toilette, again, Gesina. We see her looking out at us. She seems rather disturbed. She seems uneasy as she plays with a ring on her finger. Although we're distracted by the brilliant evocation of that satin and this phenomenal costume on the page, we're drawn back to the mirror because not only do we get to see her from this direction, but we get to see her looking in this direction as well. We get this more intimate aspect of the female life. And when we go to see this painting by Dow from the Boymans Museum, again, we get the idea that we're looking into an intimate space, but a very different kind of intimate space. Once again, a curtain pulled back, a curtain on the painting or a curtain in the room. Okay, we'll accept that it's in the room. It seems to be on the other side of the arch. It's pulled back so that we get this view, and the view shows that she is perhaps getting ready to meet with a male partner. She's taking care of that earring, but she looks in the mirror, and as in the Rubens, she looks out at us. So not only are we observing her, but she's observing us. And certainly when we come down to Vermeer, in this marvelous work, the woman holding the ribbons of her pearls, lost, deeply lost in thought, in this quiet and tranquility, isolation of this room. Once again, if she looked up, she would look over to a mirror and not to a picture. Self-reflection, perhaps even love, symbolized by the mirror and the pearls. In fact, I'll mention one other detail to you. When we talk about pictures and paintings, mirrors and paintings, we come to these two paintings that are in the last room. The Hoogstraten on the left and the famous Terborch parental admonition on the right. We don't really know what's going on here. As with so many of the paintings in the exhibition, they are left unresolved, perhaps deliberately, to engage us, to make us think about not only what is happening, but what happened before and what might happen afterward. We don't know for sure what's going on here. What's really nice is that the Hoogstraten shows a similar painting here through the doorways, an intimate view through two doorways, once again with shoes and a broom, perhaps the evidence that the maid has finished and left the door open and is nowhere to be seen. And I think, actually, that we can suggest something in the Vermeer as well, to go back to the painting that you see here with the landscape and the seascape in the background, that we look through a doorway, that there is a curtain pulled back from that doorway, that there is yet another broom and yet shoes here, where she has abandoned her task for something more important, to come and deliver this letter, which is willingly received. And you can see in the painting that's here, not a painting that is here for part of the exhibition, but Caspar David Netscher from the Wallace Collection, the lace maker concentrating on her duties, where she too has taken off her shoes and put down her broom so that she can concentrate on a wholly different endeavor, with the picture in the background, helping to organize that space. And so we talk about frames, we talk about pictures, we talk about mirrors, and we talk about the open-ended aspect in the resolution of these stories. And I hope that that will help you to look and think about the paintings that are upstairs in the exhibition. The exhibition is here until January 21st, so I hope that you'll have the opportunity to come time and again and look at these small but deep reflections of the time. Thank you so much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.